Welcome to friends from the community visiting this evening. It's nice to see familiar faces. And I just want to say to people in the retreat, from interviews and from our groups and from the question and answer periods, I really am feeling deeper and deeper respect for your practice. It's a joy to be among people who are sincere about their practice and doing it. Tonight's talk is more of an experiment than usual. And it's the nature of experiments that sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. So please bear with me. The words may or may not be useful to you. If they're useful to you, that's fine. And if they're not useful to you, that's fine too. In a way, we're kind of asking words to go a little further than they're supposed to go this evening. But before I get into the subject this evening, I'd like to just digress a little, because I like doing that. The Buddha said, he said there are two kinds of rare beings, those who are generous and those who are grateful. And I just am feeling tremendous gratitude for the generosity of the people of Albuquerque. I have been really moved and impressed by what has happened in the Bosque. Walking in the Bosque, I knew that there has been a big project here in this city to clear out the invasive species and to try to give the native species a chance. I think I mentioned the other day that this Bosque, the cottonwood and willow forest along our rivers and creeks, is actually the very rarest forest in North America, and it's not quite endangered, but it's been in trouble for a few decades now. And a particular passion of mine is the restoration of Bosque. We're trying to do it. I live on the Rio Grande myself, and we're trying to do it around where I live. And it's an amazing Herculean task to take out the tamarisk or salt cedar, the Russian olive, and the Siberian elms, and it's just very moving to see it happening, and planting cottonwoods, and I don't know, are those goats eating goat heads too? They are? Whoa, baby! That's fantastic. They can come to my yard anytime. So it's just really a beautiful, and I say it's the people of Albuquerque because you guys voted for it and you're willing to spend millions and millions of dollars to do this. And I think you're being a really beautiful model for other cities in the Southwest who might do the same thing. And I want to share a quotation from the Buddha that I try to share in every retreat that I lead, because I feel they're so important. Do not believe in anything simply because you have heard it. Do not believe in traditions because they have been handed down for generations, like Buddhism, for example. Do not believe in anything because it is spoken and rumored by many. Do not believe in anything merely on the authority of your teachers and elders. Clearly he's talking about himself here, and that applies to the person talking tonight. But after observation and reflection, when you find that anything agrees with reason and is conducive to the good and benefit of one and all, then accept it and live up to it. I hope that we can really live in our spiritual communities in the spirit of these words. Essentially, the Buddha is a spiritual anarchist, and he's saying the real authority, you know, the real spiritual authority has to be in your own heart and nowhere else. And you can go to teachers as resources that can be helpful to you, but ultimately you must be the arbiter of your own spiritual practice. That's wonderful words from the founder of a spiritual tradition. And I share this talk humbly tonight, because this is a radically imperfect vehicle for the teachings. It's not awake yet. It experiences, this vehicle experiences greed, aversion, and delusion. And so so take it all with a grain of salt and don't believe it. I loved listening to Leela's talk last night. We have known each other for years, but we've never actually heard each other talk. And it was just wonderful and fascinating. It was like, it was watching this, she used the image of turn on the light for awareness, turning the light onto this thing and that thing. And what I saw was a nimble and subtle mind turning on the light here, and then going and turning on the light over here, and it was like watching a firefly, and I kept thinking, where is it going to illuminate next? And it was just really wonderful. And and I thought, well, as far as nimbleness goes and subtlety goes, my own style is about as nimble and subtle as a bulldozer. But we need bulldozers too. And fortunately, we have a mutual admiration society going. She likes the bulldozer style. I like that nimble and subtle style. So, but I wanted to pick up on, you know, she just sort of shone the light on something very briefly and then moved on to something else. I just want to pick up on something Leela said last night when she talked about, she asked the question, you know, is awareness contained in the body, or is the body contained in awareness? And is awareness in the right foot when you bring attention to the right foot? And then she asked, I can't remember exactly what the object was, it might have been a mountain, but is awareness at the mountain when you see a mountain? And I just want to kind of develop that a little bit, because I think it's really important, and I think that there's a lot of maturity of practice in this room, a lot of maturity of practice in this room. I've gotten in the habit, when I lead wilderness retreats, of doing a guided meditation, and just really kind of, just really with people, asking them to really stay with their direct experience. And I ask people to feel the limits of the body, the boundaries of the body. And then I ask them to look at the mind directly, or look at awareness. And can you find a boundary? No, really. Can you find a boundary to the mind or to awareness? We conventionally, we think that that awareness is here in this head, contained in this body. But is it actually? You know, and I've been looking for years, and I have never found myself a boundary to awareness. And so, sort of talk people all the way through this. I don't know if the weather's good tomorrow afternoon. We might offer an optional guided meditation outside, because we have a wonderful spacious view here. But just sort of talking people to the point of looking at the most distant object, which is, might be a mountain or it might be a canyon, depending on where we are in the wilderness. And just asking, after kind of this process, is the mountain outside awareness, or is the mountain not outside awareness? And if the mountain is not outside awareness, how can there be a separate self? How can it be? You know, you might try that tomorrow when you're out walking. Look at the most distant point, maybe the crest of the Sandia Mountains, and just say to yourself, not outside, not outside, and see if there can be that shift, that little shift. It's only a little shift, but it's a significant shift, that little shift that can happen where you actually experience it as not outside. In that moment, in that moment when the mountain is not outside, then the mountain is looking at itself through these eyes. And what we're seeking is what is seeing. And it can be just as simple as that. So just to kind of step back for a minute to just to share a little of the traditional teaching around this subject. Essentially, the Buddha said, I think I've quoted it already, the Buddha said, what is liberation? Liberation from greed, liberation from aversion, liberation from ignorance. This is liberation. And so these three root tormentors of our minds and hearts are the source, in many ways, of our, they are the source of our problem. All of our difficulties and pain and suffering configure around those three things, ultimately. And the Buddha was very clear that of those three, the most destructive, or the primary before the others, is ignorance. And in his description of the Four Noble Truths, we've talked a lot about Four Noble Truths in this retreat, in his description of the Second Noble Truth, he goes into detail to describe exactly how we get into this problem. With the 12 steps of dependent origination, each step dependent on the previous one. And it starts with ignorance. It starts with not knowing what is true. And the Buddha said, if you just remove ignorance, then the whole thing disappears. So what is this ignorance? He defined it very clearly. It's very specific. He said this ignorance has to do with not understanding the Four Noble Truths, that suffering exists, that there's a cause of suffering, that the causes of suffering can be removed and suffering will cease, and that there's a way to the end of suffering. So ignorance is not understanding that critical understanding about how it all happens, how we move into suffering and how we can move out of suffering. It's essentially what the Four Noble Truths are about. It's also ignorance about the law of cause and effect, that everything we say, everything we do, and everything we think is significant, and it has an effect, it has a return. And so it's believing that we can speak or act without consequences is a deep mistake from the point of view of these teachings. Ignorance is about that too. And then especially ignorance is about not understanding what the Buddha described as the three universal characteristics of all phenomena. All phenomena whatsoever, all conditioned phenomena. The first is that everything is impermanent. The second is that everything is unreliable or unsatisfactory because they're impermanent. And the third is that no phenomenon is self. And so ignorance is believing that which is impermanent is solid and continuous and permanent, and that which is unreliable and unstable and unsatisfactory is reliable, stable, and satisfactory. And believing that which is not self is self. And so just picking up on this ignorance, this not understanding, about self, that all phenomena are not self. I lost my train of thought. Give me a minute here. The Buddha describes in a wonderfully succinct teaching, he describes not self. And actually, Brian told this story in a Dharma talk outside of Prescott, Arizona, when we were teaching together a few weeks ago. And I'll do the short form, and correct me, Brian, if I get any details wrong, but there was a man named Bahia in ancient India who was a respected spiritual teacher who thought he was liberated. And then he discovered that he wasn't. And this was someone who was a very sincere practitioner, a very sincere spiritual seeker with humility. And he asked around, who can help me? And they said, well, there's a teacher way up in the north who can help you. And so he set out on foot, and he walked a very long distance looking for this teacher. And he finally located his teacher, and he went to the place where the teacher was staying, and they said, "Well, he's here, but he's out on alms rounds right now. He's out begging for his food. And wait here, and he'll come back, and we'll have a meal, and then he'll give you the teaching." And Bahia would not wait. And so he went into town looking for that teacher and found him in the street and said, "Please give me the teaching." And the teacher, standing there with his begging bowl, you know, said, "I'd be happy to give you the teaching, but I'm begging for food right now. Come have a meal with us and then I'll give you the teaching." And Bahia said, "No, I can't wait." He said, "Either you might die or I might die before that meal is over. Please give me the teaching now." And so that teacher, standing in the street, standing in the dust with his begging bowl, he had to be very pithy. And I'd like to read you the teaching, because it's essentially the teaching of not self, of non-self. He said, "Then Bahia, thus must you train yourself. In the seen, there will be just the seen." So if I may just interpret it a little bit. When you see something, if your eyes are open right now, just look. There's an object, there are the eyes, and then there's consciousness or knowing that something is seen. And in that moment, this is why mindfulness is so extraordinarily powerful. In that moment of just seeing, there are no concepts, there are no distortions, there are no projections, there's no neurosis, there's no self and no concept of self in that moment. Or when you hear a sound, the ear, it is heard. In that moment of bare hearing, there is no distortion. And this is why the Buddha said that every moment of clear mindfulness is a moment of nirvana. This is the significance of our practice, because it may feel insignificant feeling the breath, but every moment of clear feeling of sensation is a moment that's free of the distortion. It's free of the ignorance or delusion of separation. That's the thought that I've lost. That essentially this ignorance is about believing in separation. And this is and coming to wisdom or coming to deeper understanding is to see that separation doesn't exist. It's an illusion. And so in that moment of bare knowing, there's no separation, there's no distortion. So this is so to come back to the teaching, "Then Bahia, thus must you train yourself. In the seen, there will be just the seen. In the heard, just the heard. In the sensed, just the sensed. In the cognized, just the cognized. That is how, Bahia, you must train yourself. Now when, Bahia, in the seen there will be to you just the seen, in the heard, just the heard, in the sensed, just the sensed, in the cognized, just the cognized, then, Bahia, you will not be defined by it. And when, Bahia, you will not be defined by it, you will not be in it. And when, Bahia, you will not be in it, then, Bahia, you will not be here, nor there, nor midway between. This is the end of suffering." That sense of inside and outside, of subject and object, of self and other, disappears. It's not here, it's not there, it's not in between. There's only one reality. And this is the end of suffering. So the story is that Bahia, on hearing these words, became fully liberated. And then a few minutes later, he was gored by a bull and died before lunch. So what I find really interesting, just to come back and to pick up the thread of what Lila was talking about last night, is that the special power of awareness, if we want to use the word awareness, is that when awareness is strong enough, it breaks down that sense of separation. So if I could go back to an example, to actually read again a passage that I read the other night, a passage from Thomas Merton, just to get some sense about. So here's a guy, he's standing, he's looking at some statues that are carved into a big cliff. And the seeing, the awareness is so penetrating, it penetrates into the object, into the statues, to the point where the statues are definitely not any longer inanimate dead objects. They come alive. But that power of awareness doesn't just move out, quote unquote, toward the object. It also moves in to the psyche in the same extraordinarily penetrating way. And the sense of self and other disappears until you don't know which is which. And so if I may just read this passage once more, I'll just read a part of it. I'm able to approach the Buddhas barefoot and undisturbed, my feet in wet grass, wet sand. Then the silence of the extraordinary faces. Now, is that the silence of the faces, or is that also the silence in quote-unquote his psyche? The great smiles, huge yet subtle, filled with every possibility, questioning nothing, knowing everything, rejecting nothing. The peace not of emotional resignation, but of Madhyamaka, the middle path, and of Shunyata, of emptiness, that has seen through every question without trying to discredit anyone or anything, without refutation, without establishing some other argument. Now, are all of these qualities happening only in the stone? Or have somehow these qualities between this in this interaction, with the power of penetrating awareness going in both directions, are these qualities also manifesting in the writer's mind, in the writer's psyche? I was knocked over with a rush of relief and thankfulness at the obvious clarity of the figures. Again, whose clarity? The clarity and fluidity of shape and line, the design of the monumental bodies composed into the rock shape and landscape, figure, rock, and tree, and the sweep of bare rock sloping away on the other side of the hollow, where you can go back and see different aspects of the figures. And here's where it all breaks down in terms of subject and object, of self and other. Looking at these figures, I was suddenly, almost forcibly, jerked clean out of the habitual half-tied vision of things, and an inner clearness, clarity, as if exploding from the rocks themselves. An inner clarity exploding from the rocks. This guy doesn't know anymore what's inside and outside. Became evident and obvious, the queer evidence of the reclining figure. So do you have some sense of what has happened here in terms of this transformative moment? That awareness, if you can look clearly enough at any object and have that awareness penetrate into the object deeply, it will equally penetrate into your own quote-unquote psyche. And in that moment, there is no separation. So it's easier to do this with stories than it is to just talk about it abstractly. So if you remember the Rilke poem that I read, this guy goes to the Louvre, he sees another piece of dead matter, another rock, and it comes alive too. It comes so very alive that it's a whole lot more alive than he is. It's alive as a human, it's alive as an animal, it's alive sexually, and it's alive with some kind of spiritual light that comes bursting out of it. You know, so it's coming out of every part of the statue has light pouring out of it, and there's no part of it that isn't seen. The one who is seeing. Do you have some sense? Well, what's the statue and what's the psyche of the watcher? that distinction has disappeared, and it's very possible that that brilliant light is the light of awareness itself that shines out of the statue with such extraordinary vitality and life. This power of awareness to break down the sense of separation. And I'd like to share just one other story. And I want to acknowledge the fact that these stories just happen to be, and really happen to be, because I wasn't planning to do this talk, happen to be all about men. And I want to just acknowledge the fact, not only do women capable of this kind of deep seeing, but at least according to my teacher Dipama Barua, women awaken much faster and more easily than men. And she stated that over and over again. It was so interesting. I mean, she lived in Calcutta, in a place and time where feminism wasn't very established. And she would say again and again, "You poor men, you just take so long." And Joseph Goldstein once asked her, "Well, is there any hope for men?" And she said, "Well, yeah, look at Jesus, look at Buddha." So there's hope for us guys. So this is an account, and I think it's an amazing account, because we don't often get a chance to get on the inside of these experiences. This is an account of a Japanese businessman named Koun Yamada, who actually became a great Zen teacher, Yamada Roshi. And he's writing right after this experience, and so it has a wonderful freshness. This is November 27th, 1953, and he's 47 years old, and he's writing to his teacher. "The day after I called on you, I was riding home on the train with my wife. I was reading a book on Zen by Sono, who, you may recall, was a master of Soto Zen living in Sendai during the Genroku period. As the train was nearing Ofuna Station, I ran across the line." And this line actually was taken by this writer from Dogen Shogo Genzo, who took it in turn from an ancient Chinese work. And this is one of my favorite statements that I've ever read, actually. I ran across the line, and he's quoting, "I came to realize clearly that mind is no other than mountains and rivers and the great wide earth, the sun and the moon and the stars. I came to realize clearly that mind is no other than mountains and rivers, the great wide earth, the sun and the moon and the stars." Do you see? No separation. That mind is your mind. It's not just this guy's mind. It's the mind. So it's just beautiful to... I'd read this before, but this time it impressed itself upon me so vividly that I was startled. I said to myself, after 7 or 8 years of Zazen, I have finally perceived the essence of this statement, and couldn't suppress the tears that began to well up. Somewhat ashamed to find myself crying among the crowd, I averted my face and dabbed at my eyes with my handkerchief. Meanwhile, the train had arrived at Kamakura Station, and my wife and I got off. On the way home, I said to her, in my present exhilarated frame of mind, I could rise to the greatest heights. Laughingly, she replied, then where would I be? All the while, I kept repeating that quotation to myself. It so happened that that day, my younger brother and his wife were staying at my home, and I told them about my visit to your monastery, and about that American who had come to Japan again only to attain enlightenment. In short, I told them all the stories you had told me, and it was after 11:30 before I went to bed. At midnight, I abruptly awakened. At first, my mind was foggy. Then suddenly that quotation flashed into my consciousness. I came to realize clearly that mind is no other than mountains and rivers and the great wide earth, the sun and the moon and the stars. And I repeated it. then all at once I was struck as though by lightning. And the next instant, heaven and earth crumbled and disappeared. Instantaneously, like surging waves, a tremendous delight welled up in me, a veritable hurricane of delight, as I laughed loudly and wildly. Ha, 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 ha. There's no reasoning here, no reasoning at all. Ha, ha, ha. The empty sky split in two, then opened its enormous mouth and began to laugh uproariously. Ha, ha, ha. Do you see no separation? He's laughing, the sky's laughing. Later, one of the members of my family told me that my laughter had sounded inhuman. I was now lying on my back. Suddenly, I sat up and struck the bed with all my might and beat the floor with my feet as if trying to smash it, all the while laughing riotously. My wife and youngest son, sleeping near me, were now awake and frightened. Covering my mouth with her hand, my wife exclaimed, "What's the matter with you? What's the matter with you?" But I wasn't aware of this until told about it afterward. My son told me later he thought I had gone mad. I'd come to enlightenment. Shakyamuni and the patriarchs haven't deceived me. They haven't deceived me. I remember crying out. When I calmed down, I apologized to the rest of the house who had come downstairs, frightened by the commotion. It feels useful that we can get into on the inside of somebody's experience with this kind of vividness. And can you see the same thing is happening? It's about awareness, which is a kind of unified field which breaks down that sense of me and it, that awareness moving in all directions and holding everything. When it becomes powerful enough, then there is only one reality. Mind is everything. Everything is mind. So just a couple more stories, because I think they're useful. And as I share these stories, that we can, as you listen, you can do two things with them. You can move into comparing mind and say, "Oh, I'm so sorry that hasn't happened to me, and maybe it can never happen to me," and get into some kind of trip, which is a lot of selfing. Or you can let that go and realize that these are just ordinary people like you and me, just as this guy was an ordinary person like you and me, just as the Buddha was an ordinary person like you and me. So, just a couple of stories of things that have happened in the last couple of years. In the last retreat we did here, the last residential retreat we did here in Albuquerque, we were at the Kenoshin Center in the South Valley. And on the last day of that retreat, just after breakfast, I was walking down the hall, and I met a student walking in the other direction with whom I had worked for years. Whose face was shining, and his eyes were very clear. And so I grabbed him and took him aside into the library there at the Kenoshin Center so he wouldn't disturb anyone. I said, "What happened?" And he said he had come on some of these wilderness retreats and had experienced that guided meditation, and so he was using language that I had used. He said, I don't know how to describe it, but the world saw itself through these eyes." And he also said, I just saw that I was nothing more than a collection of stories, and all the stories fell away." And we talked some more, and I gave him some advice about how to continue with practice. And I cried afterward. And then I was teaching with Irina Wiseman, who's now retired, but Irina and I have for years and years partnered in retreats, and we kind of do the good cop bad cop thing. And I'm the guy who's wonderfully supportive and kind of the cheerleader, and Irina is tough. Those of you who know her, and I say this with great admiration and appreciation. So she had an interview with this person later that day, and she said, Well, just because you're awake, it doesn't mean you're not going to fight with your wife. That's a reality check. But again, that same quality of awareness which breaks down any sense of separation. And then finally, just the final story. Maybe 10 months ago, something like that, early this year, I got a call from someone I've known for many years, who's a former student. He's no longer a student, doesn't need me as a teacher any longer, but it's long ago, in 1995, he called me. He was a Trappist monk in a monastery in South Carolina. And he'd gotten a hold of Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield's book, Seeking the Heart of Wisdom, and found instructions for doing Vipassana practice in the book. And he was doing 5 hours of sitting a day for weeks and weeks without any instruction beyond what he had read in that book and with no guidance. And so he called me. He called Spirit Rock Meditation Center and he said, I need to talk to a teacher. And I would prefer to talk to a gay teacher if you have any. So they put him in touch with me. And I was fascinated, you know, by this person. And so established a long-distance sort of relationship. I was guiding in any way that I could. I was supporting his practice. And eventually he left the monastery. At one point he became a Buddhist monk in West Virginia. And then left that because his aging mother was very ill and needed support. And so he went home to Columbus, Ohio to support his aging mother, who's now about to go into hospice. And more currently in his life, he's taken vows with the Franciscans and he still wears civvies. I'm not sure exactly what form of Catholicism it is. It's Franciscan something or other. And he's worked as a chaplain in hospice. I've told the story to the Albuquerque Sangha, so forgive me if you've heard it before. And so he, as a hospice chaplain, he was sitting with a woman who was dying of metastasized face cancer, and most of her face had been removed. And she was horribly disfigured, and she was a relatively young woman who had been very active in her life, and she was feeling extraordinary bitterness about what had happened to her, and so she was expressing this bitterness. And his task as the Buddhist chaplain, as the Catholic chaplain, Catholic Buddhist something chaplain, was to provide a really empathic presence for her and her experience. So he gave her that. And then he came back after a while, maybe a few days or a week, he came back and he sat with her again. And there was this same intense bitterness over what was happening to her. And then he noticed a tear that was kind of coming down what used to be a cheek. And he took a risk, and he told her, "This is, you know, I'm stepping outside of my boundaries here, but I sense that you might want to change your relationship to what is happening to you." And she said, "Yes, I would." And so he paused and thought, and then he said, "As far as I can tell, the only choice is complete surrender." And those happened to be the right words at the right time from the right person, whatever. And she heard those words and she went into complete surrender. And she died very much at peace. And a couple of weeks later. So he told me all this and I said, "Gee, that was a nice thing to do. That was good." And he said, "Yeah, but there's more." And he said that he was, sometime after her death, he was driving in a traffic jam in Columbus, and he was irritated by the traffic jam. And he just had this moment of self-realization. He said, "Here I am creating suffering for myself by resisting this traffic jam." And then he asked himself, do I have to wait until 2 weeks before I die to surrender completely? And in that moment, his mind surrendered completely. It was a very big change happened. And I've talked with him a few times in recent months. And that change has been really significant. You know, for a long period after that, he was not experiencing suffering. He said, you know, sadness is not coming. Anger is not coming. Grief is not coming. What's going on here? I said, enjoy it. You know, and then more recently, kind of the stories have been coming up again. But he said, you know, these stories come, but I see right through them and they fall away. And again, you know what? I find it so fascinating in terms of the causative influences of what happened in that situation. Is that he was there and really present for her, for this woman who was dying, and he was able to help her. But through that connection, you know, and this happens every time we are absolutely present for another being, that sense of self and other can get very attenuated, you know, so that there's a deeper and deeper sense of connection or identity with another being. And I think that's almost certain what happened. So you know, whose mind was it that was influencing whom in that situation? If he hadn't had that encounter with her, would the big opening have happened in the middle of a traffic jam? You know, I think it's just so interesting that quality of awareness. And it can happen when you're looking at a mountain. It can happen when you're sitting with a dying person. It can happen in a traffic jam. It can happen anywhere. And all that has to happen is for awareness to be clear enough and strong enough to break down the sense of separation. So it's my profound hope, you know, that all of us will develop an awareness pure enough. Actually, the awareness is already pure. If we can just sense an awareness pure enough that it can dissolve the sense of separation, for us to be able to experience the unity of reality, you know, to know that our heart absolutely is mountains and rivers and the great wide earth and the sun and the moon and the stars. So you might just, as we continue with this retreat, just play with the idea of not outside. You know, we have this conventional way of thinking that there's a me here and an it everywhere else. And it's just not true. And so if it's useful, you know, to look at a human being and say, not outside, and how does that feel? To sort of break down that conditioning or that belief in separation, that ignorance about the truth that all phenomena are free of self. You know, or I find it particularly for me, and I found it for others, with others as well, it's especially useful to do this out in the natural world. You know, my Joseph Goldstein, the Jewish stand-up comedian, once said that when you practice indoors, the neurosis bounces off the walls and ceiling. And when you practice outdoors, the neurosis gets to go all the way into the universe. And for me, there's some way in which when I'm in at the enormous spacious environment of the natural world, and I can feel the innate silence and stillness of the natural world, that great spaciousness and clarity and that silence and stillness begins. It serves as a kind of mirror for this heart. And it's much easier for me to get to a place of non-separation in the natural world. And so you might find it useful doing walking meditation outdoors tomorrow. I don't know if rain is coming, but If it's okay, I mean, if you're able to see at a distance, you know, look at the most distant thing, and then have a sense of not outside. It's not outside. So, let's sit for a moment.